Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
They were missile shots heard round the world. What is North Korea up to and why? I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. In the past day, North Korea has fired 7 missiles, triggering concern and condemnation around the world. How should the United Nations respond? What will China, North Korea's close ally, do to calm the situation? One of the missiles fired had the capacity to reach the western United States, but failed. How serious is the threat posed by North Korea? First, here's the news. I'm Sarah Terry, back with Which Way LA on KCRW. North Korea has launched 7 missiles in the past day, causing concern around the world. The rockets all fell harmlessly into the Sea of Japan, but there are concerns that a defiant North Korea could launch more missiles. What kind of threat does the regime in Pyongyang pose to its neighbors and to the United States? How will China, North Korea's close ally, respond? Will the Bush administration now have to shift more of its attention to North Korea? My first guest is Don Kirk, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor based in Seoul, South Korea. He's speaking to us from London. Thanks for being here.
Right. Good to be with you.
How big of a surprise was this launch?
Actually, it was a kind of a big surprise because everybody had been expecting North Korea to launch a missile, but then they didn't do it, and people were sort of thinking, well, maybe they're not going to do it. China and Russia had both urged North Korea not to do it. Of course, Washington had also, which may not mean a lot, and South Korea had urged North Korea not to do it, but with China asking North Korea, please don't do it, there was some sense that they would hold off, so clearly they didn't do that, and now all bets are off as to where they go from here.
Knowing what you do know about the region, was there any significance to the launch of those missiles on the 4th of July?
Well, I do think that probably was not a coincidence. North Korea staged its own fireworks display, shall we say, and I think that they also had in mind the launch of the American space shuttle as something to try to upstage with their own missile launches. So none of this is coincidental.
Well, again, regionally, in this whole issue of saving face, all those missiles fell harmlessly into the Sea of Japan, sort of prompting both concern, but some people saying North Korea can't really do anything. What did North Korea hope to accomplish, and did it accomplish it?
Well, the failure was that the Taepodong, the Taepodong 2, actually.
This is the missile that was capable, supposedly, of reaching as far as Alaska.
Right, that's the long-range missile. The failure was that didn't go anywhere. But and that may or may not have been a failure. Maybe they were just trying to fire at a very limited distance just to show that they could do it. They didn't necessarily want to offend Japan as they did in August 31st, 1998, when they fired a Taepodong over Japan and landed in the northern Pacific somewhere. But the Scud missiles, the short-range Scuds and Nodongs that they fired, weren't really failures. They certainly didn't want to hit Japan with them. They didn't want to start a war right now, right then and there. But they did test fire them and show that they have the muscle to do it. So I'm not sure that those missiles were failures at all.
So what is the impact regionally on what North Korea has shown that it can do in the past day?
Well, I think there's a great increase in tensions. I think the most aggrieved, the most outraged, I should say, are the Japanese. They view this as a real threat to Japan. The United States may talk about the possibility of a missile hitting the West Coast or Hawaii, which is a very remote possibility at this stage. But Japan is well within range, not just of the long-range Taepodong, but of all these Scud and Nodong missiles.
And what about the reaction in South Korea?
The South Korean reaction is strangely ambivalent. A lot of South Koreans just aren't all that worried. They know that North Korea has not only missiles but artillery pieces that can rain devastation on Seoul and other major centers, but they don't think that North Korea is about to do that against South Korea. And also, South Korea's complexes about Japan are such that they don't really get that upset if North Korea wants to intimidate or try to intimidate the Japanese with a few test missiles. So the South Korean reaction, I spoke to people in South Korea today, actually. The South Korean reaction is not all that strong, and certainly not the kind of outrage that reflected in Japan or in certain circles in the United States.
North Korea is typically portrayed as a very isolated, very cut-off country with a relatively unstable leader, Kim Jong-il. Is there anything changing in the situation within North Korea that's leading to these actions?
Well, there's no doubt that it's isolated. He may be driven by a certain desperation. Some people think that the U.S. action that resulted in the freezing of North Korean accounts by firms doing business with the United States, the U.S. action to try to counter North Korean counterfeiting may have driven Kim Jong-il in a corner where he feels the need to flex muscles and to engage in sort of threatening tactics. So perhaps he's more isolated than before, and perhaps he feels the need to show the United States that to defy the United States, and also to challenge Beijing, to challenge China, not to defy China militarily, but to show China that China can't really pressure North Korea either into going along with whatever the rest of the world may want.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Good to talk to you.
Don Kirk is correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor based in Seoul. For White House Response, we'll be going now to Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So the White House had a fairly low-key response yesterday. What are they saying today?
Well, it's still low-key in the sense that behind the scenes, at least, White House officials are saying that what these tests show is actually the lack of capability of the North Korean missile system, that actually the capabilities are much less than they were in the 98 test that so outraged people in Japan. And they're also being fairly low-key about the kind of response they think is going to come out of the Security Council. While they obviously want to see a unified response and they're pretty confident about getting a lot of agreement on that, their real focus is on restarting these talks, these six-party talks, as they call them, about the whole range of North Korean issues.
We were just hearing from Don Kirk from the Christian Science Monitor that although that long-range missile, the Taepodong 2 missile, didn't reach its goal, fell far short, that the short-range missiles, the Scuds, that were perfectly capable launches and showed that North Korea could do something in the region. Is the White House downplaying that or just not concerned about it?
Well, one White House official just told me, look, these are missiles that are based on World War II technology. And obviously there is a serious position in terms of the threats faced by allies in the region. And the White House is doing a lot to say, of course, it's there to support allies, especially Japan and South Korea. There's no reason to be shocked or surprised. And I don't know whether this is a sort of certain dialing back here. Of course, last week there were very strong signals from the White House trying to warn North Korea off these tests. And this week, now that they've happened, again, there is an effort to sort of say there's nothing new here and there's no additional threats that these missile tests pose.
Is there any perhaps philosophical tension within the White House in terms of how to deal with the fact that George Bush once called North Korea quite emphatically part of the axis of evil? He singled them out as one of the three main countries in the world that posed a threat to the United States. And here now, they're downplaying the threat. What's going on in the balancing of these two perspectives of North Korea?
Well, there is an ideological debate, a very hot one, inside the administration, as there has been for the last 6 years, about how to deal with North Korea. But it doesn't revolve around this idea of North Korea being an evil regime. In fact, people on both sides of the debate, the hawks and the doves, as it were, agree that there is nothing redeeming about the North Korean regime. If anything, President Bush's attitudes towards the regime has hardened. He told Bob Woodward in 2001 that he loathed Kim Jong-il, and just last week, he was talking with a Japanese prime minister there about what he called one of the most moving moments of his presidency, which was a meeting in April with a Japanese family of a teenager who'd been abducted by the North Koreans some years ago. So his feelings about Kim Jong-il and about the regime are just as strong, but there is this debate about how to proceed, and the hawks, as best embodied by the vice president, Dick Cheney, have long said these talks, these six-party talks, are doomed to failure. For the moment, the doves have won the day, and the president has stuck with both the talks and the idea that a package of incentives could be constructed that would dissuade North Korea from continuing with its nuclear program.
Incentives in terms of trade? What kind of incentives?
Trade and security. Some of these things are not well defined. They were supposed to be defined as the North Koreans engaged in the talks. Of course, the talks have been effectively deadlocked and non-existent for the last several months. So, but there is talk of both security package and economic incentives. But of course, all of that is predicated on North Korea verifiably and irreversibly giving up its nuclear programs.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff is senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. We're going to go to William Arkin now, a military affairs analyst for NBC and Washington Post online columnist. His blog, Early Warning, can be found at WashingtonPost.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to talk a little bit about these missiles. Can you just sort of sum up for the layperson what kind of missiles we're talking about here and what kind of threat they could or don't pose?
Well, there are three different missiles that were fired by North Korea. One is an intercontinental missile, the Taepodong. The second were a set of regional missiles of a 600-mile range, the Nodong or Rodong missiles. And then the third were Scud missiles, similar to the kinds that Iraq used in the Gulf War, of about 200-mile range. So,
is this like pulling out a rusty arsenal on the part of North Korea, or do they have some
rusty,
shiny new weapons?
Well, come on. This is a country that can't make a domestic toaster that works. I find it hard to be too concerned about North Korea's missiles, but yet those missiles are powerful symbols. They're symbols of not just a capability to attack countries far away from their own shores, but also they are symbols of North Korea's recklessness. So I think that in the military terms, looking at the North Korean problem through the nuclear or the weapons of mass destruction lens, that is, looking at the missiles and the nuclear program as being their primary threat, is a mistake. This is a Stalinist country that has hundreds of thousands of men under arms in a conscripted army that sits 40 miles from Seoul.
So a land invasion is more of what would be...
Well, that's where the pain really is. That's mm-hmm. where the real threat would be if we cornered North Korea or if they felt like their state was failing and they lashed out. So to me, focusing solely on the weapons of mass destruction question and ignoring the fact that this is a state that has complete and total control of a large military force that I'm not, again, saying is competent, but it's there, I think blinds us a little bit to what our options actually are.
Was there just a highly symbolic act then in the firing of these missiles, and was it for a domestic audience as much as an international one?
Well, it's not for a domestic audience yet, because the North Koreans haven't even announced this missile launches domestically. I believe their lead story today on North Korean news was Kim Jong-il's visit to a tire factory. So I think that the problem is how we look at the North Korean problem itself. And since the early 1990s, we have made North Korea what it is by virtue of being obsessed with its supposed nuclear capability and the development of its missiles. North Korea probably has been on the front pages more as a result of having WMD than it ever was in its previous incarnations. And it has the attention of the international community, and it has all of the benefits, if you will, associated with that. If we saw North Korea as what it was, a failed state, a Stalinist state, a crazy place that is really a threat to no one, we might actually be able to formulate a better policy and a better strategic plan for dealing with them. But I think we spook ourselves to some degree by the nuclear and missile capability, and as a result of that, I think we also put ourselves a bit into a straitjacket as to what to do.
Okay, let's bring another guest into the conversation. Ambassador James Lilly served as U.S. Ambassador to South Korea and China during the Reagan and first Bush administrations. He's currently a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
You've just heard William Arkin's take on how to perceive the situation. I'm curious what your response is.
Well, I think he's got a good point in saying that we have to go beyond the weapons of mass destruction. This is a problem involving a failed state, a Stalinist state that's got a very sick, destructive system. But we didn't cause this. They've been that way since 1950, and they've been developing nuclear weapons for probably 20 years, and they've had a whole series of very violent actions, which we didn't provoke. They blew up the South Korean cabinet in Rangoon, 83. They blew up a South Korean airliner in 87. They've carried out these raids on South Korea through submarines. Most of them failed. But they've got a track record of being violent and very destructive. I think the missile shots is, I think it's true that they've used it for symbolic purposes, but it's also a very strong message to Japan and South Korea that we can wreak tremendous havoc on you were we ever the subject of a military attack. And I think that subject is emphasized by this. As far as the long-range missile, both of them have blown up. The United States is not under any great threat from North Korea, except for our troops in Okinawa or possibly Guam, Japan, South Korea.
From your understanding of the region, why now?
Well, because I think it's a very desperate state. I think they're in very bad shape in terms of their economy, and the economy is their Achilles heel. And they are very weak there, and they need the help of the foreign countries. And they use these missile shots to shake down their neighbors. They've been shaking them down for nuclear weapons, various other things. And the missiles have gotten them quite a bit of money. They sell them, and they use them for threats, and they get paid off for not shooting. It's a good gimmick for them. Right now, I think they want the emphasis on them. They want to take it away from Iran. They want to focus on their own problems. And they want to get the attention and probably use this to ratchet up their demands. But I think we deal with them the way we want to deal with them, which is through the six-party talks and perhaps under that rubric some bilateral discussions as we've been having, as Michael Green has pointed out.
We're listening to Ambassador James Lilly. Just for our listeners, the six-party talks that we're talking about are between the United States, North Korea, South Korea, China, Japan, and Russia. North Korea walked out of those talks last September. I'm going to bring another guest into the show who very kindly has been waiting to join us. Thank you, Peter Hayes. He's co-founder and executive director of the Nautilus Institute for Security and Sustainable Development. It's a non-governmental research and advocacy group focusing on global issues, including North Korea and Asia. He's joining us from San Francisco. Thanks for being here. Thanks for waiting.
Sure. Glad to be with you.
Tell us your perception on the symbolic nature of these launches and what we were just hearing from Ambassador Lilly about the appropriate way to respond.
Well, if I can say that I agree that this is, in fact, an issue to do with the nature of the North Korean state and how to resolve the dilemmas that that state poses.
Internally.
Internally for itself and for the rest of the world. Jim is a very important figure at the American Enterprise Institute, where Nick Eberstadt has promulgated a theory about the North Korean state for the last 15 or 20 years, which is that it's about to collapse. And the problem with that position is that it keeps on surviving rather than collapsing. And so the current basis of American policy, which appears to be to squeeze North Korea into capitulation, particularly the notion that it's a narco-criminal state, sometimes people use the shorthand Soprano state, seems to be not working. Instead, we seem to be ratcheting up the tension, not bringing it down. And I myself favor a different theory of the North Korean state.
Which is what?
Which I call the stalker state. I think that North Korea for nearly 30 years actually has been stalking the United States and seeking a different kind of relationship, not necessarily a friendly one, but not one as hostile and as antagonistic as it was during the period that Jim referred to of those provocations and violence in the 1980s, which in fact has ended for the most part in the last decade, as I think is widely recognized, once Kim Il-sung died and Kim Jong-il took over in 1994. And so just as an individual can be stalked, and when that stalker is spurned, their advances are spurned by the stalkee, they then harass them. I think North Korea is doing exactly the same with their nuclear threat. They're trying to get our attention and force us to have a relationship with them that deals with their concerns. And the more we ignore them, the more they will charge at us with their form of harassment to get our attention.
Ambassador, I'd like to get Ambassador Lilly's response on that thought, the stalker state versus the soprano state. What would you say about that? What's your response, Ambassador Lilly?
Well, I don't think there's any question they're a soprano state. They've been caught counterfeiting and narcotics and this sort of thing. That's been going on for many years. It's a great source of revenue for them, and that's why they were so concerned about our action with this Macau bank. But I think also it's very important to realize this is not an American problem.
But first, before you get back to that, I want to hear what you think about the stalker state idea. That's a very provocative idea.
I think it is. There's merit to that. Yes, they want attention. Yes, they're stalking us to try and get our attention, get us to engage them on their terms. But it seems to me that the six-party talks is what really scared them, because if they ever saw any kind of coalition or a cohesiveness among the parties in the six-party talks, the other five, that they would probably be in a very tough position. The thing about these recent shots is this really pushes it into a national problem. And I think if you take action in the UN Security Council, it should be aimed specifically at their missile program. Do not get involved in the economic sanctions. You have to do that other ways. And yes, they are stalking us. Yes, they are trying to get attention. Yes, they are shooting down our planes, capturing the Pueblo, murdering our people on the DMZ. This is an attention grabber. I agree. But I think the recent thing shows a rather shallow approach, because if you take their missiles and match it against Discovery, we put a missile 50 times, 100 times stronger than theirs for peaceful purposes into the atmosphere on the 4th of July. They shot ugly little missiles into the Japan Sea to threaten their neighbors. My sense is you've got the high ground now. Use it effectively. Chris Hill's going to try to do this. Get some sort of cohesion with the Chinese. I'm not saying get them to capitulate. Get them to change their policies and begin to really get rid of this nuclear weapons and weapons of mass destruction program.
Let's go back to Peter Hayes then for your response. What's the appropriate way to be dealing with the situation now? And how would you respond to the idea that those were sort of, as we just heard from Ambassador Lilly, just ugly little missiles?
Well, I think we'll have a problem in the Security Council, because there's absolutely nothing illegal about what the North Koreans were doing, whether it was a booster rocket or a ballistic missile, which we'll never know, of course, because it blew up. But the fact is that they tested now because there was no marginal cost to the regime. The Chinese at the six-party talks had failed, and everyone knows this, most importantly, the Chinese and the North Koreans, to deliver the United States in a negotiating framework that the North Koreans could respond to, and the Chinese are furious at the United States for that. So I don't think that they'll be upset diplomatically about the North Koreans going ahead with the test. But I don't think they'll do anything, because they would have done the same as the North Koreans in the same circumstances, as indeed they did with the former Soviet Union when it refused to share its weapons of mass destruction and missiles back in the late 50s. South Korea has gone to the right at its domestic elections 3 weeks ago, so there's really nothing lost for the North Koreans in alienating the South at this point. They know that the Bush White House is not going to negotiate with them on the issues that they care about. And it's always fun to poke Japan in the eye. Hmm. So at the end of the day, I actually disagree profoundly with Jim about what motivates this test. I think it's actually motivated primarily by trying to reinforce the domestic legitimacy of the North Korean leadership. And I must admit, it was 8 years ago, but I was in North Korea at the time of the first Taepodong test.
The one that went over Japan?
Yeah, and I was told by friends there, North Korean friends, that was primarily 80% roughly about declaring fealty or faith, leadership, faith in the leadership by the scientific sector. About 15% putting pressure on Japan, and about 5% about negotiating with the United States. I mean,
well, if you were to put this in a context, we've referred to several events of sort of the past two or three decades of incidents and relationships with North Korea. Is there any building sort of momentum or strategy behind what's going on? Are these, you raised the question earlier of the theory that North Korea was going to be collapsing. It hasn't done that yet. Is it possible to have a clear sense of what's going on within, and how does that play out in terms of any kind of a long-term strategy?
I think the short answer is you're looking into a black hole, and light goes into a black hole but generally doesn't come out. So it is difficult at best to know what's going on. Bob Scalapino, perhaps America's premier Asia specialist, is actually in North Korea today, and presumably he will get some insight and bring that out when he leaves in a few days. But you know, in truth, we're all left speculating and looking backwards, not forwards. We can find some patterns in North Korean rhetoric and behavior, and perhaps the axiomatic rule is that when the North Korean or any totalitarian regime declares a pending or actual increase in military strength to its own population, you can pretty much, going back to the Nazis, find that that's a pretty good rule of thumb that it's true. They don't generally lie to their own people about their own military prowess. Now, as one of your guests earlier, Bill Arkin, pointed out, so far as we know at this stage, they haven't actually declared this failure to their own people, and in fact they may never do so. I guarantee heads are going to roll in Pyongyang about the failure, but
Well, what was their expectation? What failure actually happened? Did they think it was going to go as far as Alaska?
Well, I must admit, I've been predicting failure, because if you look at how things are made in North Korea, and I've been in many of their factories.
Somebody said they couldn't even make a toaster.
Yeah, well, I mean, basically things are made artisanally, one by one, and a missile is a supreme example of systems engineering with tens of thousands of parts working in extreme conditions. And so the chances that the North Koreans can actually make something that works in a serial fashion is very close to zero. And so what we have learned today with this failure is that they almost certainly cannot and will not be able to deliver a weapon of mass destruction using a missile against anyone, even on their own territory. And so at this stage, if they were working in their missile development program to American standards, it would take them 40 successful development tests to get to an operating missile. At this rate, two failures in 8 years, it'll take them 160 years to get to 40 tests, and so far they've had 2 out of 40 failures. So, it's good that they tested. We know what's going on.
Peter Hayes, Executive Director of the Nautilus Institute for Security and Sustainable Development, talking to us from San Francisco. Let's go back to Ambassador James Lilly, currently a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. I'd like you to address that question of the idea of North Korea being a black hole. You were in the region for quite a while and know it well. Both that and the question of why North Korea hasn't collapsed yet, as one of your colleagues at AEI has predicted.
Well, it's always the fashionable thing to say it's been the greatest American intelligence failure and it's a black hole. The facts don't support that. I mean, we know a great deal about the North Korean leadership. We got this great defector, Hwang Jong-yup. We got his Kim Dok-hong, his other man. We got a real sense of the people that drilled Kim Jong-il. I'm not saying we knew the answers, but I'm saying we've had 50 years of military negotiations. We've had the agreed framework. We've had the Chris Hill talks. We have a sense of how these people act and the stimulus they take and they work against. Second, I think characterizing Chinese approach to things as furious anger is a little bit off the mark. The Chinese are very calculating. They know what they're going to do. And they were not furious at the United States for not going to the meetings, because they knew perfectly well we were meeting the North Koreans on the side. Michael Green just confirmed that. Chris Hill did it too. We were doing it. And third, this another thing you've missed, is the fact that the Chinese are hurt by these missile shots, because it creates a atmosphere in Japan, other places, possibly even Taiwan, maybe even South Korea under new government, to build up a capability to deal with this, which in turn is aimed at the Chinese. The last thing the Chinese want to see is cooperation on ballistic missile defense. The North Koreans have just given that a real shot in the arm.
I think the two of you have some, between you and Peter Hayes, there's some interesting back and forth going on, and I'd like to just redirect you a little bit, both of you, to another question that's part of this equation on how we're responding to North Korea. And it's this. Why do we respond differently to North Korea than we do to Iran and Iraq? And Ambassador Lilly, I'd like you to answer that first.
Well, they're entirely different countries. We have a very different relationship with each side. We were involved in Iran very heavily until 79 with the Shah. We know the Persian background to a degree. We deal with these people differently. They did seize the hostages from us, and we broke diplomatic relations with them, which we had. With North Korea, you're dealing with a very different kind of a situation. The latest dynasty of a series that goes back maybe 3,000 or 4,000 years, with the idea of a god king, and as the Koreans, North Koreans, do these things, as one wise person said, it's a question of co-option, repression, and deification and purity. They co-opt the powerful class with goodies. They repress anybody against them. They deify the leader in the true tradition of Korea, and then they claim they are the pure Korean, that everything else is contaminated with Western imperialism and capitalism.
Okay.
So they push this theme very hard, and it has resonance in the South and across the world, in Burma, Uzbekistan, you name it, Zimbabwe. They've got friends.
Okay, I'm going to have to, we're nearing the end of the show, and I need to give a one last word here to Peter Hayes, but thank you very much, Ambassador Lilly. Peter Hayes, I'd like your response first on that question of why North Korea is treated differently than Iran and Iraq, and then whatever your final thoughts are on the situation.
I'll come back to Jim on a one-on-one basis on the issue of the threat direction of their missiles, because I think they're also aimed at Beijing as much as other countries. But on the Iran-Iraq issue, well, I think the differences, other than the ones that Jim just adduced, are that we, in fact, do know a lot about North Korea, as he was just saying, and we are, in fact, depending on their rationality, that the notion that deterrence works and that we have them thoroughly deterred. The other big difference is the North Koreans have nothing of great value except some threat to our vital interests in South Korea and the regional economy.
You're meaning no oil, in other words,
yeah,
is
no,
what
no
you're saying.
No oil. There's no resources in North Korea of significance. And finally, there is a difference in the mentality of Koreans, which Jim is correctly saying goes back thousands of years, versus the leadership of Iran, which is the North Koreans are not fundamentalist in some of their approaches to world affairs. They are highly realist in geopolitical terms, and basically it boils down to a very old Korean phrase, which I'm sure Jim knows, sword to sword, rice cake to rice cake. It really boils down to that, and if you respond with a sword, you'll get a sword in your face, and if you respond with a rice cake, you'll get one right back.
I'm very sorry we have to end this fascinating conversation, but we're out of time. Thanks so much to all of our guests. That was Peter Hayes from the Nautilus Institute for Security and Sustainable Development. We also had Ambassador James Lilly, currently at the American Enterprise Institute. We were also joined by Bill Arkin, William Arkin, Military Affairs Analyst for NBC, Richard Wolf from Newsweek Magazine, and Don Kirk from the Christian Science Monitor. Which Way LA was produced tonight by Karen Radziner, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, and Katie Cooper. Our technical director is Mike Newport. I'm Sarah Terry, sitting in for Warren Olney. Join us again for Which Way LA on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.